now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Robert Hulse. Robert Hulse is a lifetime UFO experiencer, contactee, an investigator in his own right. His website is macclesfieldufosociety.co.uk. And I've been meaning to get Robert on the show for a long time because Robert has a lifetime of experience. And he's there in a place near Manchester, UK, which is, I feel, it's somewhat of a hotspot of UFO activity. Robert has been involved in a lot of crop circle research. So without any further ado, Robert Hulse, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Yeah, thank you, James. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, for the benefit of our listeners, Robert, tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to find yourself involved in all these types of experiences. When did the experiences start for you?
Well, the first experience I had was when I was 2 years old. I was in the street. And my mom had just put me outside, and my sister was a couple of years younger than me, and almost. And so she'd gone inside to bring her out. But as I stood there in the street, this light came down in front of me and hovered in front of me. It was shaped like a light bulb with the bulbous part at the bottom, and it looked like one of the old 200-watt light bulbs, you know, quite a big one. And it hovered maybe 5 feet off the ground, just, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 feet in front of me. And I just stared at it. Gradually, it just disappeared. Now, the important thing is that the day was completely calm, and it's incredible that I have a almost photographic memory of the situation, which is ridiculous for a two-year-old boy. But I can see the houses across the street. I can remember what the weather was like. It was just a dull, grey, drizzly sort of day. Absolutely no chance of lightning or ball lightning or any of that kind of rubbish that people often use as excuses for some of the weird lights that we see. And that was the beginning of it. So I was introduced to them at that age, I guess. Interestingly, many, many years later, I found a report in one of the main newspapers over here from that period, which we're talking about 1954, possibly 55, which detailed a large UFO craft that looked like a big light bulb. So I don't know whether there was any connection or not, but they obviously showed their interest in me there. And also, I suppose the first clue that there was something a bit strange about me is a photograph that I have from when I was a little baby and in the garden down at my grandparents' house, and sat on my cousin's knee, and directly above my head, possibly, I don't know, maybe 10 feet above my head in a perfect line from the top of my head, there's a ball of light. So I think that's a clue that there's something a little bit different about me anyway. Yeah, that was the first thing. And then when I was, how old, five, had the weirdest experience of being in bed at night, and suddenly this huge bull African elephant appeared in the corner of the bedroom, and it was incredible. You know, just its head and these massive white tusks swaying from side to side, and I was absolutely petrified, and it was as real can be. It occupied all that bottom corner of my bedroom, and I tried to shout my mum, and nothing would come out of my throat. I was almost paralyzed with fear. But eventually I did manage to shout at her, and she came from the next bedroom, and she stood in the doorway. And I thought, Mom, come in, I need you, you know. But she just stood there, and she could see, obviously, that something was really frightening me, and it made her apprehensive, I think. Anyway, I looked at my mum, and I looked at the elephant. And then I looked at my mum, and I looked at the elephant, and it was still there. And I thought, well, if mum's real, then the elephant's real. But then gradually it faded away. Now, I know that doesn't sound like anything to do with aliens and UFOs and stuff like that, but I'm convinced it was a visit from a being of some sort. It was so powerful. And in later life, a friend of mine who is one of the most psychic people that I've ever come across, and I've come across a lot of people like that, told me that on one occasion he saw Ganesha standing behind me, the Indian elephant god. So, you know, I do feel a very strong connection there. So that was when I was five, round about the same time. I was playing in the field under a tree trying to make a bird's nest. You know how young lads try to make bird's nests out of bits of straw and mud and what have you. And I was making a terrible job of it. And then the next thing, these two people came and stood at the side of me, just out of nowhere. Slim, tall people dressed in what looked like one-piece silver suits, you know, like cycling gear, you know, tight fitting stuff. And they spoke to me, but for the life of me, I've no idea what they said or what happened. All I can remember then is walking back to my house with a bird's nest in my hand that was absolutely perfect. And there's no way on earth that I could have made that bird's nest. So I think that was another visit. Then when I was seven, I went on holiday to a place called Prestatyn in North Wales. It was that with my parents and my sister, who was 21 months younger than me, and still is, of course. And so on this occasion, we were just through the sand dunes onto the beach. And my father said that Mum and Dad were going back to the caravan to make something to eat. And so it was a lovely day, sunshiny, beautiful. So I said to Dad that, you know, would it be all right if we just hang on here for a little while before we come back to the caravan? And so they said yes, but, you know, my dad was very strict, very Victorian in his attitudes. And so we behaved ourselves, you know, we really did. And so they went back to the caravan, and the next weekend we played, you know, in the sand for a little while perhaps. And then the next thing we remember, Jane and I, is that we were walking along the single track concrete road that went through the caravan site. There was only one road, and it was much later in the afternoon, obviously. And it was raining, and we were getting wet, and we were very disorientated. We didn't notice the caravan, even though it was right at the side of the track. And we should have noticed it, but we were so disorientated that we just carried on walking down the track. And, you know, my sister, she even remembers the clothes that we were wearing at the time. It's a strong memory for her too. And fortunately, we were taken in by a family, very nice family. And then they went and found my parents. And they were absolutely distraught because, and a little angry, because we'd been missing for 4 hours. And my parents had been tearing all over the place trying to find us. But of course, they didn't realize, and nor did we, that we'd been taken. Of course, in later life, with all the experiences I've had, we now know that we were taken. And it's very interesting that only a matter of a couple of months ago, I was talking to a friend who tells me that she also was on holiday as a child in Rhyl at the same time. She was also taken from the beach in Rhyl. Now, Rhyl and Prestatyn, I don't know, 4 miles apart in North Wales. So it's obviously a real hotspot of activity. And I do recall many years ago actually seeing a photograph of a UFO on the hillside, directly behind where we were taken from the beach. So other people obviously have had experiences there. So that was that one. Then when I was 9, again, my sister and I were on holiday at Llandudno this time, which is, I don't know, maybe about 7 or 8 miles past Rhyl on the same coast. And suddenly, let me explain. Llandudno is a seaside resort with a big headland made of limestone called Great Orm, O-R-M-E. Orm apparently stands for dragon in the old English. Suddenly, from being in the digs, you know, where we were staying, we call them digs, you know, the bed and breakfast or whatever it was, Jane and I were suddenly found ourselves at the bottom of the Great Orm on the other side, away from the town, Llandudno. Now, there's a single road that goes all the way around Great Orm. There's a drop from that road down to the sea of about 100 feet. And there's a small stone wall which goes along the side of the road all the way around the Orm. So there we were, down by the sea. My sister tells me that we were actually on a small piece of beach on sand, which surprised me because I didn't even think there was sand anywhere there, but she said that was the case. And the tide was coming in, and we were forced to climb up these rocks. And it's 100 feet climb up a cliff face. And I was really scared. I didn't like heights at all. And partway up, I froze. And my little sister gave me the confidence to carry on. And so eventually we got up to the wall where the road was, and I managed to get her over the wall, and then I made the mistake of looking back down, and I froze again. And but again, she helped me to get over the wall. So there we were, we just on the road, the tarmac road, and we both walked a few paces along the road. And the next thing, we're back in the digs, in the boarding house, where we were, you know, earlier on the day. And my parents have got no idea any of that happened, but my sister has perfect memory of all of that. So you know, that's just some of my early experiences. I could go on and on, James. Is everything else? Is
that okay? Yeah, I mean, what you've shared thus far, and I definitely want to hear more, it's instructive. Like, the part about Ganesh, I thought that really jumped out at me. The Indian, well, some people describe Ganesh as like kind of a war deity, or he's venerated, I suppose, for more than one thing. It reminded me of a story that Pam Hamilton told me years ago when she was a little girl. On her wall, suddenly she started seeing dinosaurs, like a movie of them, but it was like real life, and it was like real action footage of real dinosaurs that was being projected on her wall when she was a little girl. So when and she was a lifetime abductee too. So when you mentioned that thing about the elephant, I knew immediately it had to do with your experiences.
Oh yeah, for sure. After being taken at Prestatyn the first time, when we came home, I suddenly started with terrible nosebleeds.
Oh.
And yeah, and every time in those days we just had a sink to have a wash in, you know, it was a bit primitive. Every time I put my hands in the water and brought the water up to my face to rinse my face, as soon as I touched my nose, blood would pour out of it into the water. And this lasted for, well, at least 2 weeks anyway. It was, it was so unusual because I'd never had nosebleeds before in my life, and I've never had them since. I'm absolutely certain in hindsight that I had an implant in my nose. I mean, I've got quite a few other implants in me as well these days, but I'll perhaps talk about those later maybe. Yeah, I mean, probably the most prominent one I've got is in my hand, in my left hand, in between the base of my thumb and the wrist. It's about halfway. I was with two other people at the time. This would be about 2008. And we were on holiday together, and we were taken, all three of us, and all three of us had a double puncture mark in the same place on the hand. Actually, the lady had hers in exactly the same as me on the left hand, and the man had his on the right hand, in exactly the same place. And over the years, I've had quite a bit of pain from that particular implant, and it's actually grown a bit of a lump, a bit of a hard lump there, and it's also very noticeably weakened the left thumb as well. Now, I mentioned that in particular because I know several other people who have got the same implant in the hand, and it also weakens their thumb dramatically too. So, but I've never been scanned or, you know, or checked out like that, you know. But I absolutely know what this one is.
What I've noticed, and small sample size to be sure, I know others that have had similar experiences to myself, not just of the ET variety, but of, and I'm not suggesting that you had undergone something like that, but yeah. I know people that have had my lab type experiences, and what they reported to me is some of them have had problems gripping things after a while, like holding on to things. Small items, they lose grasp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's happened to me too. I hate to say it, but it drives me crazy sometimes. I'm holding a paperclip and I drop the thing.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether there's any connection. I don't have any recollections at all of any MyLab experiences, but I guess it's always possible because during most of the abductions, in fact, almost all of them, I have very little memory of what actually takes place, you know, when I'm taken. Only on one major occasion, when I was taken down in Wiltshire back about 2007, taken from the caravan I was staying in, with my research colleague, Dave Caton, who's well known for all the animal mutilation research that he's done over here. Yeah, I was aware that I was taken on that occasion and aware of being returned, so that I was in a room on a ship of some kind above the caravan, and I couldn't see the instrument or machine or whatever it was which was making the effect, but suddenly I heard this buzzing sound, which started very low but very quickly increased in intensity until it was like having your head inside a nest of angry bees. And what I'm convinced it was doing was actually vibrating every atom of my body, which I think is what enabled them to pass me through the solid material of the roof of the caravan and back into my bed. And even when I was back in the bed, and wide awake, I could still hear the buzzing sound, which was very disquieting, to say the least, because it was so loud and so incongruous, because there we were in the campsite in the middle of the countryside at about, I don't know, 4:30 in the morning, when it should have been as quiet as a mouse. And yet I'm lay there with this tremendous buzzing around me. And in fact, David, in the bed across the walkway, was awake, and he couldn't hear a damn thing. Only me. And he was probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 feet away from me. So obviously, whatever energy it was that was creating this effect was directed at me, and it was very specific to me. And of course, I've come across that in other cases since then. You know, I think Betty Andreasen had a similar experience with her family. Another interesting aspect of that was that even though I was really a bit unhappy about the thing, you know, the noise more than anything else, both of us were sound asleep within probably 10 minutes, which is ridiculous, because that simply wouldn't happen in an agitated state. But I know from experience, from talking to many, many abductees, that this is exactly what happens. They are put to sleep, basically, and that's what happened to us. I'm certain we were put to sleep. And the following morning, I slept soundly until about 8 o'clock, and then I went to have a shower. And so I'm standing in the shower in the shower block, and the hot water hits me, and I suddenly notice that my private parts are a bit tender. And so I look down, and actually under the foreskin, I was cut. I had a straight cut under the foreskin. Also, I had two very prominent puncture marks on my stomach in the location where a woman's ovaries might be. You know, if you can just imagine that. So below the navel and on either side. And they were really, really prominent. But I didn't feel any bad effects, other than the fact that it was obvious to me that I had an operation, because my stomach inside was sore. And I'd had an operation before in a normal hospital, so I knew what that felt like. And even when I came home to Macclesfield, that soreness lasted for certainly 10 days anyway. But as I say, I didn't feel any ill effects whatsoever. And, I was watching our friend Carla Turner. I know she was a very important lady in your life. And although I never met her, I knew about her years and years ago, and I was very impressed by everything that she did. The main point that she made, I think, was that, you know, because these beings have the ability to affect our minds, we really can't be sure of anything that happens when we're in their company or with them. And these people who have this, you know, look at it through rose-tinted glasses, I think they're mistaken, frankly. I don't know whether I've had bad experiences on board ship. I know I've been on board ships many, many times because of all the flipping puncture marks and triangle marks and stuff that I had on my body. I mean, when I counted those up, I thought many years ago, I came to about 25. So I reckon I had that number of experiences at least. And I think that's another aspect of this, James, that people think that they, you know, they might have had one experience or two or three perhaps, But usually, in my experience, if you've been taken at all, then you're likely to have been taken all your life. And it's not going to stop either. It's going to carry on. Doesn't matter how old you are, it will continue. And so people like me and yourself, we have to just get used to that idea, I think, and not let it impinge too much on our lives and try and live as normal a life as we possibly can. And I think that's why I think you do such a great job in bringing this to the public's attention. And I, over the years, have tried my best to make people feel a little less alone with these experiences, just to let them know that that it's happening to many thousands and thousands of people worldwide. I think we become like a big family, I think.
Carlo Turner made a very good point, which he alluded to a moment ago, Robert. One facet of these experiences when we're in the presence of these ETs is virtually everything we're presented with is alien-controlled information. Everything from the setting, the environment, what you perceive, what you feel. Yes. So she always made the point of, Carla Turner did, of reminding us never to take things at face value, especially when it comes to the feel-good aspect, because these beings have the means to put us in a kind of nirvana kind of state, a euphoric kind of state. And another thing that you pointed out in a couple of your experiences, and I'd like to hear more about your childhood experiences going forward, it speaks to, Robert, on those two occasions at least, the callous indifference those ETs had, returning you and your sister back in a driving rainstorm, your parents frantic with worry.
Yep.
You know, and then on the other occasion, they drop you off at the bottom of a headland. Yeah. You literally have to climb your way out, right? And Daryl Sims, an American UFO abduction researcher, he talks about a case, I think in Texas, where the ETs stupidly dropped off a little boy into the swimming pool in the apartment complex and the poor kid drowned, right?
Yeah.
And I've been dropped off above my bed. You know, it's like, get me down onto the bed. Don't drop me off in midair. You know, and that's how people get hurt. That's how, you know, well, one of the ways. But it just speaks to the callous indifference that at least some of these ETs have towards us.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I guess I'm like a lot of people in that we like to think, at least, that we're not just in the hands of really bad ETs. I suppose that's for our own peace of mind that we naturally gravitate towards that point of view. I just think, well, you know, I'm 67 years old now, and I'm in pretty good shape, fit and well and healthy. So I kind of think, well, you know, so far maybe they haven't done me much harm. I don't know, maybe I would have been fit and healthy if I never met an ET in my life, you know. I don't know, but I suppose the beneficial aspect of all of this, if there is some, and I believe there is that it's opened my mind to, a much wider understanding of life and the universe, and above all, it's allowed me to make friends with so many people all over the world who have also been taken. What I've noticed, and I wouldn't be surprised if you've noticed the same, is that the vast majority of the people who are taken are well above average intelligence.
That's true. Yeah. we're routinely depicted by the media as being a bunch of whack jobs, but some of the sharpest people you'll ever meet have had these experiences.
Absolutely. And also, I've noticed that so many of the people who get taken, I mean, a vast proportion are psychic individuals who are gifted individuals. And it also seems to me that after we've had encounters with some of the ETs, at least, those psychic abilities seem to be enhanced. You know, so I think, you know, from that point of view, there is a positive aspect to it. But as I say, fortunately, I don't think I've had any in my lab experience.
You're not missing anything.
No, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Quick comment, and then I'd definitely like you to continue, Robert, because you really blown me away with a lot of your revelations here. The thing about what happened in the caravan park, and for the benefit of some of my American listeners who may not be familiar with the UK terminology or Australian terminology, when you hear someone refer to a caravan, think RV, recreational vehicle, motorhome. Caravan park, think motorhome park, RV park. When you were returned and you were taking a shower, and then you notice that your privates were sore and sensitive, yeah. I knew, one of the people that I knew was a ex-Air Force individual, black gentleman, really nice, sharp guy. When he was returned, around the bottom of the crown of his penis, there had been some kind of cutting that had been taken place where they'd done some kind of incisions to him. And I've come across others that have had similar experiences as well. But his story, because he related it in an abductee group support setting, and he did it with a bit of humor, and we all had a good laugh. But Robert, I must say, I feel the reason that you've got such a well-balanced and such a depth of understanding about this is the way you carry yourself. You don't carry yourself as a victim. Like a lot of us, you're very inquisitive, you're very curious, and you really want to get to the bottom line of what's going on. And so I really applaud you in that, because you know, you're able to speak about this in a very forthright manner, which is very encouraging to the people who are just coming to grips with this.
Yeah, I think it's so important that more people are bold enough to come forward. You know, it's time. As I say, for so many years, I've been trying to get the message across to people and told to take more water with it, you know, the whiskey, you know. But I've always persevered because I didn't mind being ridiculed at times, because I knew there would come a day when we would be vindicated and all the work that we put in will bear fruit. You know, all the secrecy that surrounds this subject, it will be seen for what it is. So for me, it's very important to be open and honest. And I can tell you that on another occasion, this would be, I know I'm jumping about quite a lot, but here we go. But it would be about the year 2000. I'd been away on holiday in Wales again, but in a different location. And I was really well. I was really fit and strong at that time. I'd been swimming in the sea, and I'm quite certain that the ETs were aware of my condition at that time. And I came home, and I was in bed, and my wife was asleep at the side of me. And suddenly, I found myself being levitated off the bed. And that was the first time that I can recall that happening. And I didn't like it at all, simply because of the feeling of being out of control. But I had this feeling that if I could somehow just move enough just to touch my wife, even with a finger, it would somehow break the spell. And that is exactly what I managed to do. And I dropped back onto the bed. And because of all my other experiences, I knew damn well that, you know, ETs were involved. So I looked around the bedroom, fully expecting to see one, but I didn't. And so eventually I went back to sleep. And the following morning, again, having a shower, as soon as the hot water hit my old man, again, it was pain. And I looked down, and there upon it was the outline of a red triangle, sort of printed on my old man. And it's strange how I reacted to it. Well, it's not strange because I know this is how we get conditioned, but I didn't, you know, jump up and down and make a big fuss about it. I kept it to myself, and after about 3 or 4 days, it had disappeared. So that was that, I thought. Until about a fortnight later, I went to a conference in Leeds, the big Leeds UFO conference, which was run by Graham Birdsall, which was a brilliant event with tremendous speakers from all over the world. And on this occasion, Yvonne Smith was one of the speakers. Now, you perhaps know her.
Yes, from Southern California. Yes.
Yeah. And so she was talking about different cases that she'd investigated and helped with, and mentioned the Allagash tour. And then she put this slide up on the big screen, which was mostly denim, but out of the middle of the denim was cut a square, beyond which you could see some skin, and upon the skin was a red triangle, exactly the same as I had, and she said to the audience, "I bet you don't know what part of the body this is," and of course everybody, but I just sat there in shock. Because I had actually told my research colleague, Dave Caton, and that he was the only person I'd mentioned it to. And he sat next to me, and our mouths opened, and that somebody else had exactly the same thing as me. It was just the outline, the red triangle. It wasn't filled in sort of thing, you know? So I wondered whether, you know, that was one of the Allagash twins or whatever that had that. But it's almost as though I was meant to be there to see it, you know? You know, that's the very obvious thing about my life, is that they are always in my life, regardless. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if I've got a couple of them standing either side of me now, you know? And I've got used to it because of all the different things that they've done. I mean, one interesting thing that they did, I'm very impressed by a lady that you'll know, Kim Carlsberg.
Yes, she's also from Southern California. She wrote In My Wildest Dreams, I think, that book about her story.
It's over there in my bookcase.
Yeah.
What happened maybe about 7 years or more ago, 7 or 8 years ago, I borrowed that book from a friend of mine, Phil Hoyle, who is one of the top researchers in this country. And I had it at the side of my bed. But it's important here that my wife, who I was married for almost 40 years, she hated this whole business, this whole damn business, and with a passion that was hard to believe. My wife died about 5.5 years ago. Now, it was only after that she'd gone, that an auntie confided in me that my wife had been so afraid that I would be taken and not returned. And I had to admit that I'd never looked at it from her point of view. I'd always been so intent on trying to make sense of it for myself. I didn't see her side of it. And I do regret that now. But, you know, life's a learning experience, isn't it? You know, and we're gathering knowledge all the time. But anyway, to get back to the book. So my wife was still alive at this time, and the book was at the side of my bed. And I thought, no, this isn't really fair. She doesn't like this stuff, so I'm going to put it in the bookshelves behind a curtain at the side of my bed, but behind a curtain and out of the way. And so I didn't bother looking for the book for about a month. And when I did, it had gone. It had disappeared. And I thought, oh, crikey. You know, perhaps my wife has found the book, and or my daughter even, because they both hated this whole business, which made it so difficult within the family, which often happens, you know. you'll know, I'm sure. And I thought maybe she's found it and she's put it in the dustbin and got rid of it. So anyway, a few months later, I went to see Phil and I had to apologize to him that I had not got his book. And I would have to get him another one, which which was something, because I didn't realize just how expensive they are to buy these days. But anyway, he said, that's okay, don't worry about it, we'll sort something out. So anyway, my wife then became ill and she got cancer. And after about 12 months on from that time, when the book disappeared, my wife actually died. And so about a week or two after she had died, I went out on my bicycle to just get some fresh air. And on the way back, I called at my parents' house. And it had been a ritual for me to go to my parents' house every Friday for many years to have my Friday midday meal. And so I had been there on the Friday. This was now Saturday. It was only a small bungalow. So I went in on the Saturday, called on my mum. I walked into the room, into the living room, and I just casually glanced around. And there, on a very tiny bookshelf behind my dad's armchair in the living room, was the copy of Beyond My Wildest Dreams by Kim Carlsberg, sticking out like a sore thumb. As you know, it's got it's a wider book than it is tall. You know, it's different to most shapes of books, so it sticks out on the bookshelf.
Interesting artwork on the cover too, if memory serves.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a half human, half alien.
Yes. Face. Yes.
So, and it's in colour. So there's no way you would miss it. I mean, and I was there the day before, and my dad told me that he'd actually tidied that bookshelf during that week, and there was only about 10 books on the shelf. So, so what I'm trying to say is that the ETs obviously took the book at that time because they were perfectly aware that my wife was going to become ill and that it was important for me to give her my full attention. But as soon as my wife had gone, bang, it's back.
And yeah.
Now you've got to get down to business again. Okay? Now, there's more to that story, which is really weird. And that is that what some people I perhaps would call a shapeshifter. So that my face has been seen to change by a number of witnesses. I don't know, maybe at least 8 or 9 times, I suppose, and on a couple of occasions with 3 witnesses. And at first, that's something which I just didn't believe because I wasn't aware of it happening. But over time, I met other people who had the same experience. I realized that this is a reality, that my face does change. Just going back to the book again, I really, really love that book, Beyond My Wildest Dreams, because there are quite a number of things in the book which are so familiar to me, having had the same experiences. And so I was determined I was going to get a copy for myself eventually. So I decided I was going to go on the internet, and I found one in America, a secondhand one. And so I bought that book, and finally it arrived. Of course, as you had pointed out, that the front cover is a half-human, half-alien face. And, of course, that exact scenario has happened to me, where only half my face has changed. The other half stayed the same. 2 witnesses to that event. But at this time, and still today, I'm very friendly with a lady in Ireland, called by the name of Dr. Mary Helen Hensley. And I mention her name because Mary also has many, many ET experiences, and she's not afraid to admit to it. So it's not a problem. But on this particular, bear in mind, so I'd received the book, the day before. And then Mary sent me a message to say that she was getting ready to go out and doing her, putting her makeup on in the mirror, when her face suddenly changed, half of her face, to an ET. The other half stayed human.
Wow.
So she took a photograph of it, right, with her mobile phone. And she messaged me to tell me about this. And she was just about to send me the photograph when the photograph on the phone changed back to a normal human face. And that was the day after I received Kim Carlsberg's book. Do you understand? I'm trying to get people to know that these beings, whoever they are constantly working within our lives.
Yes.
To teach us things, educate us, and open our minds to other possibilities.
Well, one time I went into a used, it wasn't just a used bookstore, although they had a lot of books there. They had like used everything there pretty much. And of course I gravitated towards the book section, and I came across The Watchers, Raymond Fowler, Betty and Drayson, an absolute classic book, absolutely classic series of books. I'd already read it. In fact, I've already had a hard copy of it at home. So I just set it aside, right? And then Kylie comes along, my wife, and she goes, oh, this looks interesting. Let's get it. Well, you know, the hard copy I had was at a friend's place, you know, where a lot of my books are, right? So I thought, well, yeah, rather than go back there to get that copy, I'll just pay a dollar or two here and she can have this copy, right?
Yeah.
So I found a few other books to my liking. And then we're standing in line waiting to purchase these books. And then I'm holding this bundle of books in my hands. And then a piece of paper falls out of the Watchers paperback book. I bend down, I pick it up. And my name is written on the paper, James Bartley. And then it had my old website, which I haven't used and it's probably disappeared off the internet eons ago. And I go, this is an interesting synchronicity. And even the page number had significance, right? That it fell out of. So yeah. We pointed this out to the person, you know, at the cashier, right? Yeah. They must have thought we were babbling idiots or something because it was such a strange synchronicity. And that was a book that I had really no intention of buying. Had I been there alone, I would have just left it on the shelf.
Yeah.
But Kylie said, oh, get this book, right? There you go. It's just one of those. And another quick story, some of my listeners have probably heard me tell the story before, but it involved a disappearing bottle opener, which is in the shape of a totem pole. And I was going through a spate of experiences at a time, and I didn't realize at that time that I was an abductee. But long story short, I misplaced this bottle opener, right? I needed it to open a beer. And I got so obsessive about finding this thing that I literally began moving furniture out of my bedroom to find this thing, right? Yeah. And after a while, I gave up. I mean, literally, I was moving the bed, the mattress, cabinets. And then I gave up out of frustration, went to the kitchen, and I grabbed a can opener that's got the bottle opener hook at the end, right? Yeah. I come back to the bedroom, and there, sitting on the desk, in the center of a bare desk, is the bottle opener, right? So those kinds of anomalous things, they happen to people like us. And yeah. I think gradually, incrementally over time, it's just a way of saying, look, your conception of reality isn't all it's cracked up to be. There's a lot more to it than you can even imagine.
Absolutely. Well, that just reminds me of a time, I remember this thing, I'm guessing about 2005, something like that. I woke up one morning and my eyesight had been changed so that it was not impaired in any way. But everything I looked at had a black diamond shaped mesh upon it. So the walls, the ceiling, even the porcelain of the toilet had a black diamond shaped mesh upon it. This lasted for about 2 weeks.
Righty.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you've perhaps seen windows that have had, like, diamond leaded lights, lead in the window, maybe.
Yes. Naked.
Yeah. Well, that's what it looked like. And they were just as if you've got a thick black felt tip pen and drawn diamonds on everything that joined up into a mesh. And so it was pretty obvious that I was being shown that the nature of reality is not what we believe it to be. If somebody said it was a hologram, I would be quite happy to believe that after seeing what I saw. Now, throughout my life, I had a very favorite uncle who I confided in with all this stuff. So I told him about my eyesight changing. And I was really quite disappointed in that he didn't seem to take it on board. And I was really quite upset by that fact, because being believed is so important to people like us, isn't it? You know, especially if you haven't got many friends, you know, who you can confide in. Anyway, so this lasted for about 2 weeks. And it didn't fade at all. And then I woke up one morning and it had gone. And it was just back to normal. So I went down then to my uncle's house a day later, maybe. And he was in a right state. And he said, Robert, I've got to make an appointment at the doctor's. Everything I look at's got a diamond-shaped mesh on it. And I said, Uncle, I told you. This is what they did to me. And you didn't believe me. So they've done it to you. In order so that you realize that I was telling the truth. And that, you know, so in this respect, I do have these experiences where they do help me to prove my case, if you like. And I said, don't worry. I said, give it a fortnight. It'll be gone and you'll be fine. And he did, and it was.
Yes, there's even an element of humor in some of these experiences.
Oh,
one to see it in a humorous light, you know, these particular instances. Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment with Robert Hulse. Robert, do you want to give your website address again?
Well, it's just Macclesfield UFO Society. Put it in Google and you'll find it.
And we'll have a link to Robert's website. We've still got another segment to go. This is James Bartley. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.